This is Angle of View. Today is June 30th, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. This show kicks off what I intend to be a three-episode miniseries about Steven Spielberg, the biggest behind-the-camera name in all of movies and an artist I've never discussed on these airwaves apart from reading reviews of The Fabelmans and Jaws during previous Digest episodes. I had thought when I first inaugurated the Director's Profile series a few months ago that I might give him some airtime. The fact that I think about his work all the time, the depth to which I both love and hate it, is reason enough. But then I discovered two things. One, there were 8 movies of his that I'd still never seen. I hadn't realized it was that many. And two, he had a new one coming out, which would increase that total to 9. It was clear what I needed to do. Watch the 8, and watch the new one, and do an episode that ranked his entire filmography. Better than this by far, of course, would be an episode of new essay material about Spielberg, but I can't do that right now because I'm still in the middle of the same crazy life thing that began a few months ago, which is why I need a show format that can make use of my written archives in the first place. So you are getting a Spielberg ranking because that format will give me the opportunity to read reviews that I wrote over the past few years while I continue to thank you for your understanding. But wait, hold on. This new movie of his is, if you count the customary way that excludes his other TV work but includes Duel, his 35th, which means it would take me at least 2 episodes just to read capsule reviews. Plus, I really ought to devote an episode to a full-length review of the new one, so now we're talking about 3 episodes, aren't we? But why not? His career is about 3 times as big as most of his contemporaries, at least if you measure sheer volume of output, or box office returns. He got going at a very tender age, and has worked tirelessly and even restlessly in the 50 years since then, never going more than 4 years without a new release, and wedging 2 into a single calendar year more than any other artist I can name since the demise of the studio system. His feat of releasing both Jurassic Park and Schindler's List in 1993 remains the most extraordinary 1-2 punch of director accomplishment in a single year in history, one of those feats like Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point game that will stand forever. What's more, he has ranged all over for subject matter, from the earth to the heavens, and plunged into every project with equal commitment and diligence. And about half of his movies come out good. He's a shallow director, but he's the greatest shallow director of all time, a master of spectacle like nobody else, which is why he's the biggest success in the history of the film industry. I unapologetically adore his very best movies, all of which are shallow. As movie lovers know, there's no shame whatsoever in being shallow. Shame only comes when you try to prove you're not shallow and can't. And that describes exactly when and how he goes wrong. I'm going to start with the new one, Disclosure Day, since it's still in theaters. I will get around to my full Spielberg ranking next week and figure out where in the hazy middle of that list Disclosure Day belongs, after I have finished watching the rest of the back catalog, aka once I have finally summoned the nerve to watch Ready Player One. The times I've used the phrase odd little movie to describe a film number in the hundreds, Disclosure Day is the rare odd big one. It's a deeply flawed and misshapen thing. Honestly, it doesn't work. But the way in which it doesn't work is surprising. Its failures are not familiarly Hollywood-flavored, despite the extremely long and successful careers both of its workhorse writer David Koepp and its legendary director Steven Spielberg. It definitely takes a narrow view of humanity, and it feels out of touch with contemporary culture, but apart from those telltale stenches, Hollywood is mostly not the problem with Disclosure Day. Something else is. Something more basic that has to do with a dereliction of suspense thriller fundamentals joined with an overweight belief in the importance of heart, as if a big enough heart could get a dull, raggedy movie past anything. Spielberg's fatal flaw, his sentimentality, has sunk many of his previous movies, but this seems to be the first time it ever ate away at a movie's basic structure. For something being sold as a summer blockbuster, Disclosure Day is insanely cumbersome. By the end, as I watched it strain to keep all its balls in the air, I started sensing that Koepp's script was the kind that gets worked absolutely to death over a period of years in a futile effort to manage its multitudes, and then gets shoved into production despite its unsolved problems because big names are already attached, therefore sunk cost fallacy. a little research strongly supports the probability that this is what happened. Only in our case, the big name in question was Steven Spielberg. The boss man received a story credit on the film, which immediately tells you that it was his baby. A little research informs you that he originated the story based on something about UFOs in the Defense Department that he read in the New York Times in 2017, and your correct understanding of Spielberg's industry power informs you that he would have had the right to demand as many script revisions from Cap as he wanted. And how many did he want? In an interview for Backstage magazine, Cap revealed that his draft count was 42, a record high for him. Yet, the movie is a lumpy, squishy blob. Therefore, this must be because of the 42 drafts and not in spite of them. Spielberg, for his immense gifts, has never been all that good at supervising the complete arc of a complicated story. His best movies are either fundamentally uncomplicated, in a good way, or else they are written by Tony Kushner, his only regular and trusted collaborator who can manage dramatic riches. Spielberg is an emotional movie maker who, for both better and worse, thinks in terms of powerful scenes. The more control he has over a script, the truer this becomes, and in these cases, the whole movie will stand on the strength of its scenes or falter on their weakness. Consider why Close Encounters of the Third Kind is so wonderful, and why AI artificial intelligence is so irritating and repetitious, to cite two of the few Spielberg movies on which he got sole writing credit. Given his nearsighted aesthetic sense, it stands to reason that the version of the Disclosure Day screenplay that finally met with Spielberg's satisfaction would be the one that finally included all the scenes on his wish list in just the way he wanted them, never mind what a mess they made altogether when viewed from any distance at all. This is a shame, but the greater shame is that the scenes are mostly not even that great. They're big, to be sure, but they're neither lively nor involving. And the few wonders they attempt to conjure don't look or feel wonderful. It lands much closer to the AI end than to the Close Encounters end of the Spielberg spectrum. But there's yet another problem with Disclosure Day, a bigger and rarer problem than most of his other scene-oriented spectacle movies are burdened with. It has a message, and it must culminate in this message. And so besides containing all the required scenes, as Hitchcock demanded of Ernest Lehman on North by Northwest, Spielberg also required that Kep shape this script to build a platform from which this message could be proclaimed at the end. It shouldn't be surprising that the whole thing feels retrofitted, though unfortunately that understanding can only fade in after you have seen it and are reckoning with the meagerness of the experience. But it doesn't take until the end for your sense that something is amiss to kick in. This happens almost right away. From the very first scenes, nothing will quell the nagging feeling of how disjointed and graceless the story is. It keeps looming up at you. In its elemental mixture and its preoccupations, Disclosure Day is unlike any other movie I've ever seen. A sci-fi thriller about both aliens and supernatural psychic powers, in which neither of those things is the point. The aliens that come down in this one came down years ago in Roswell. And the story unfolding in the present is about the lid getting blown off the government cover-up. The work of handling and studying the aliens, for reasons of accountability and optics, has long been outsourced to the evil Wardex Corporation, whose record of managing their little green charge includes torture and murder. Our heroes, a Wardex whistleblower, Josh O'Connor, and a Kansas City weatherwoman, Emily Blunt, are characters whose prior contact with aliens during childhood abduction incidents that they no longer remember installed the special powers that enable them now to work as a two-person conduit to interpret the alien's speech, creating a line of communication from them to the rest of us. The plot consists in these two looking for a way to broadcast word of the alien's existence out to the world, their powers getting more and more activated as they work toward the light. The intended hook of the movie in the first two acts is the wrongness of government secrecy, the illegitimacy of the idea that a government's duty to its people must include suppressing certain truths at their own discretion. This is compelling enough as a theme, but once we get to the end of the movie, this theme gets folded into a more sweeping and more banal theme that is coterminous with the message that the aliens themselves want to send us in this moment of stunning new opportunity to reach the hearts of the species that has enslaved them. And this begins to jump out as the thing the whole movie has been hewn to say. that we humans are abandoning our emotional responsibilities, losing touch with our empathy, and we had better get it together. Now, this is a childish description of our moment of crisis in 2026, a reduction that utterly ignores concepts of power so that it can assign blame equally. But it contains a basic and undeniable kernel of truth. And it's a truth beneath which we feel an urgent purulence swelling up. Under the right treatment, even this stumpy message could have had some force. But under the wrong treatment, a treatment that doesn't include any recognizable human personalities nor recognizable social forces, which is what we have here, it is a platitude, and totally unworthy of the foregoing long and clanking ride. When we get to the end and the news broadcasts, which had previously been breathlessly covering an international crisis involving Korea that is alluded to on the margins of the movie in World War III tones that are slapdash at best, when those news broadcasts switch smoothly over to the freed footage of the aliens, we see a montage of people all over the world watching on their various devices with their hands over their mouths, ready to change their fundamental orientation with the world first thing tomorrow. The movie is set in the technological present, but the cultural past. Not only has Hollywood technology itself made it so that no contemporary person could ever seriously engage with supposedly real footage of aliens that look exactly like classic movie aliens, a line of trouble in the movie which smarter critics than I have already dealt with, and not only does the broadcast news not matter to people at all anymore, but it feels like a bizarre throwback to the late 50s or early 60s to be dealing with a movie that fashions this huge and unwieldy a megaphone for the job of amplifying a platitude. The central conceit of this movie devolves to a weird fantasy in which human beings' systematic abuses of one another are one day superseded and presumably vanquished by revelations about our abuses of an extraterrestrial species. And this fantasy is both the best and worst thing about it. Such a culmination is the big fat heart of the movie trying to burst the ribcage, to unite and rescue everything in it that has been murky and weak. But while you're glad to see evidence of a big heart, because it's good when movies have those, the total inadequacy of this big heart to save this movie arouses pity, and not for the tortured aliens. The only thing sillier than imagining our world screeching to a halt upon learning the truth about aliens is imagining this truth inspiring everyone everywhere to change their ways because interplanetary brutality is a bridge too far. Though it is frustratingly simplistic and continually rounds off its dramatic potentialities in these kinds of tiresome liberal ways, leaving out the social complexities that would have made it resonate, the bigger problem is that everything that does make it in is boring, muddled, or both. It's just not a well-constructed movie. It didn't seem to matter to Spielberg what kinds of turns the story took to get to that swollen conclusion as long as it got there, and that epic drafting process birthed some really hideous chimeras. It's got some expensively cool set pieces in it, including one that involves an invisible fire truck, but it separates these with vast lulls, such that when you get to a bit with some firepower, it feels like it was shoved in desperation. Those bits don't deliver any exposition. For example, the question of why the fire truck is invisible is sort of skated around. All we know is that it has to do with the device that Wardex stole from the aliens, and we're supposed to just go with it. The exposition is instead almost all spoken, and arranged along the movie's timeline in a heedless, stumble-bum way. It seems like a good idea on paper to cast Colin Firth as Scanlan, the head of Wardex, so that he can just be a bland suit like our real villains, rather than some kind of cinematic mustache twirler. But the scenes of him hunting our heroes as they seek to dump the evidence of aliens into a media outlet doesn't provoke a sense of good versus evil, not even when he uses another device stolen from the aliens to possess and interrogate the hunted or the people near them. You spend half the movie watching the bad guy tightening his grip on the good guys and wondering why you aren't feeling any fear, anger, or even tension. Similarly, you believe in our hero's mission but don't really care whether they succeed. The whole movie is just not set correctly on the tracks. Even its appearance is confounding. It contains some really thrilling shots, the likes of which Spielberg's never attempted before, including a sublime early one of O'Connor reflected woozily in the windshield of the car he's driving, and a later De Palma-esque one of a possessed Eve Hewson as she looms up behind her victim with a butcher knife, her face reflected in the blade as she comes back to her senses. But Janusz Kamiński's lighting is deeply weird here. At once muddy, so you're viewing all of it through Vaseline, and simply off, with tons of artificial-looking lens flares and a depth of field that makes it look like the actors are always in front of painted backgrounds, so you feel like you're having a derealization episode. This kind of visual alienation aids neither the suspense nor the warm, loving soul underneath the suspense that is trying so hard to come out. I think Spielberg, who has worked with no other cinematographer over the past 21 films, long ago reached the bottom of Kamiński's trick bag, but the abandonment of camera basics in this one still took me by surprise. This is no longer about the bag, but the hand holding it. If Disclosure Day had been made by a young artist, just starting out, we would admire the ambition it takes to attempt this much inside a familiar genre, and excuse, or at least comprehend the reason for, the parts that trip and fall, and hold out hope for the day when the artist would either transcend the action thriller or focus their ideas into the kind of tight and driving expression that the genre demands. That it was made as the 35th feature film by the 78-year-old most successful film director in world history makes it something else. I'm not sure what. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find this and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.